Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, to our season wrap edition of the Basement Breakdown. It is Wednesday, January 13th, as we are recording this. Alabama is now the national champions, the Alabama team that Notre Dame lost to in the Rose Bowl, 31-14. Ellen Geyer had the privilege, if you want to call it that, of being there in person in Dallas. So, Ellen, what was it like at the game? Recap it for us. Take us through that dread. How was Jerry World?
Well, just to preface, I live in Ohio, and obviously it is January, and I was really excited because I took my swimsuit to Dallas, and I was just really thrilled to spend a couple days in the sun, and it rained the whole time, and it was about 30 degrees, and that just matched my mood the whole time I was there. Well, not the whole time, maybe just like after Notre Dame lost. It was actually a lot of fun to be there, and it was great to see Notre Dame be in a such a big game and be playing in such a great stadium like that. But it was just unfortunate because I think from the first punt or the opening kickoff of the game, Notre Dame just was never in it. Obviously Alabama kicked off, and Chris Tyree couldn't even catch the ball. He fumbled it, and Jack Kaiser fell on top of it. So that just kind of set the mood for the day.
In Tyree's defense, it was more he caught it, and then he got hit so hard that the ball popped loose.
Okay, so fair. But it did just kind of set the tone for the rest of the day. So in my opinion, Notre Dame kept it a lot closer than it felt like it was. Being there watching the game, it was only a one-score lead for the majority of the first half, and then Alabama was able to extend it to two touchdowns. But the story of the day was missed opportunities for the Irish. They kept it close, but they just were never able to convert when they needed to convert. The key was they won the possession battle, but they couldn't convert in the red zone, and even when they got to the red zone, that it just all fell apart. So they were able to score on that long drive. I think it was maybe 15 or 16 plays, about 8 minutes, the longest drive in Rose Bowl history. And they weren't able to do that consistently, possess the ball like that. So that was another factor in why they weren't able to have success. So like I said, they kept it within arm's distance for the majority of the first half. Then Alabama took it to 7-21. John Doerr shorted a field goal so badly that
Was it tipped? Was it tipped?
Maybe, but it was just well short. And then Notre Dame had a big stop on the opening drive of the first half for Alabama, but then just as it looked like they were getting their legs under him, Ian Book threw an interception, and then Alabama was able to take it down and score on the next play. So that made it three touchdowns and really felt like it sealed the deal. Against Notre Dame, they had a touchdown later in garbage time and forced a field goal instead of another Alabama touchdown. But that final score of 31-14 seems a little bit more to reflect a little bit better on Notre Dame than the actual game did. Ian Book wasn't able to get much done. Kyron Williams was held to 64 yards on 15 carries. Book's completion rate was decent. I think it was about 69. But, I mean, what can you do against a high-powered offense like Alabama? No one had an answer for them all year, and Notre Dame was no exception. With Mac Jones broke the completion record for the Rose Bowl at 83%. He was 25 for 30 and threw for four touchdowns. And then, obviously, the star of the show was Devontae Smith, who, as we know now, is the Heisman Trophy winner, who had three touchdown receptions for a Rose Bowl record, seven catches, 130 yards.
Yeah, and Najee Harris hurdled Nick McLeod, so that was something to see. Charlotte, you're having some – yeah, we can see you. You're having some technical difficulties, but that's okay. We'll try and work you through. I'm going to throw it to Aiden real quick, and then you can all address this. I just wanted to ask you guys, like, you know, obviously this game was not as close as the final score indicated. Like, just what was your reaction to seeing Notre Dame's offensive approach when everyone knew going in, like, yes, they'll have to play ball control, but they'll also have to take some shots downfield if they want to have any chance against Alabama. Just, like, what did you think of Brian Kelly's mentality? and the offense going into this?
I wasn't particularly upset with how they approached the game offensively. Execution obviously being another question. I mean, yeah, you were always going to have to take chances to beat Alabama. If that was even possible this year, I don't know a team that might have even come close, really. But honestly, like, you're going to have to take chances. Notre Dame doesn't really have the playmakers to take the kind of chances that, like, a Florida did, with having, like, Kyle Pitts just being an absolute freak and matchup problem for anyone. Notre Dame didn't have that. They didn't have – you saw Ian Book, really the limitations were shown on that interception where he clearly – he doesn't throw that pass probably 9 times out of 10 during the year. He tucks that and runs. But he was clearly told that he had to take chances in that game, and it didn't really – and he wasn't able to do it. That was a throw that he should be able to make. He should be able to float that over the top to Meyer, who was behind Harris, I think, who got the interception. But, like, Meyer was there, and if he floats that over, that's at the worst incomplete, and at the best a pretty explosive play to Meyer. So I wasn't mad with the play calling from Reese or Brian Kelly's approach, per se. I thought the idea of clock control was good. I mean, I wasn't there with the you have to make this a shootout, because Notre Dame was not going to win a shootout, and they weren't going to win. They weren't going to – you had to control Alabama's offense and hope your offense had a good game. And they controlled Alabama's offense enough in this, at least in the form of making them, keeping them off the field, which made them only get, I think, what, 5 drives in the first half, or 3 or probably like 4 actually with the end of half drive. So I wasn't necessarily mad at the offensive approach as much as just the execution. I thought criticizing the play calling in this game was a little bit of a overused storyline.
Yeah, I mean, it's just it just infuriates me. That, because, like, yes, ball control is a fine approach, but you have to mix in some shots. Like, it's inherently you have to take risks to win against a team that you're so overmatched against. But
I also think in that regard, I think there were shots that were dialed up that Book didn't take.
Right. And that's,
there was I forget who it was that said it, but, like, Ian Book, probably the stage of his game that I think never progressed was his ability to recognize open versus, like, a Syracuse, or open versus Georgia Tech, versus being open against Clemson or Alabama. You're being open against those cornerbacks and defensive backs is going to look a lot different than being open against Georgia Tech and Syracuse, where you might be breaking away from guys. You're not going to do that when you're Notre Dame's receivers against Clemson secondary or against Alabama secondary. So I truly think Reese was dialing up plays for Book, and I saw, you saw it a few times where he kind of hitched and pumped like he was going to do something and didn't, because I don't think he trusts his ball, understandably, given the interception he threw. I don't think he trusts his ball against tight coverage.
Yeah, I think Braden Lindsay was apparently breaking loose on that one play where Book got just enveloped by, like, a 315-pound man and had to come out for a couple plays. Charlotte, we'll see if you're able to try talking just to make sure we can hear you.
Can you guys hear me?
Yep. Okay. So okay. What
I can't see you at all, but that's all right.
All right. So what was your take on the offensive approach to this game?
I would give it a solid B. Nothing to write home about, but I don't know what Notre Dame fans were expecting. It's not like we've been, we saw what happened against Louisville this season, put up 9 points. It's not like we're known for being a particular offensive powerhouse.
12 points.
Okay. Apologies. Hadn't forgot about that's 75% of our, or 25% of our points there. But yeah. And I will admit, I did not think the Reese hire was great last year. I've been proven wrong to an extent. He's exceeded expectations. It also seems like he has built up a really great relationship with the players, which is half the battle in terms of recruiting. But then it's not Reese as being some particular, like, offensive mastermind. I think Notre Dame fans are having to face reality that at the end of the day, there's just a group of players that are kind of reserved strictly for the Alabama, Clemson, maybe Ohio State. Like, can't really, it's they like those players are just, they're recruiting at a higher level. They have more reserves at that higher level. So as far as the offensive performance goes, I don't have too much to say. I wish they would have gotten Skoranek involved a little bit more. Maybe Tommy Trimble. Of course, he went out pretty early. But I think they could have gotten a few more players involved. Kyren Williams looked like he took care of business, and I think he has a very promising future with Notre Dame. So I'm excited to see that develop. But it seemed like a very fitting end for Ian Book's career. I think he's a great game manager, but he's not a creator in the same way that I think sometimes people have tried to compare him to, say, like a Baker Mayfield or even, God forbid, Johnny Manziel. Like, he's just not in that same tier of athleticism.
He's got the scrambling ability, I think, of both those guys to some extent, but he couldn't – once he started scrambling, there was little to no threat of him actually making a deep throw, which took away the dimension that Baker and Manziel and some guys like that brought to the table.
Ellen, you saw it in person. What do you think of the offense?
I guess my approach going into the game was that this was going to have to be a perfect game. If Notre Dame wanted to have any remote chance of being competitive, they were going to have to play a perfect game. And I don't think they did that really in any way, except for maybe a little bit defensively. Because you can play great defense, but you're still not going to be able to stop that Alabama offense. I think from my perspective, it looked like they didn't really even have a game plan. Like, once they got out there and weren't making plays, that first, second, and third drive, nobody knew what to do. They just kept trying the same thing over and over again, which was handing the ball off to Kyren Williams or trying to throw it to Cole Kmet on the interior. And once those things didn't really work, I don't think they knew what to do. They were able to control the clock when they had the ball, which certainly helped. But there's no point in controlling the clock if you can't convert in the red zone. And I think that was another problem that they had. And then I think just kind of getting – every time they seemed to get a little bit of momentum, they kind of got the wind knocked out of them. So I just think it was never really a contest, regardless of what the score might have reflected towards the end of the first quarter, beginning of the second quarter.
You said Cole Kmet. I think you meant Michael Mayer, right?
Oh, yeah. I've been watching too much NFL.
Well, go ahead, Aiden.
No, I was just going to say, I thought Brian Kelly gave up on the game really, really early. I don't think he thought his team had a chance at any point, despite what he said. To me, what that showed, I forget exactly what point the game was, but it was still to the point that a team that's competing in the playoffs should think they're able to make a comeback. Like, it was early. It was in the third quarter. They might have been down 3 touchdowns, but you should still think, as an opposing coach, you don't get wave the white flag in a playoff game in the third quarter. And it was when Book came out and Pine had to enter the game for 2 plays, and Brian Kelly ran the ball on like 2nd and 20, and then threw like a 2-yard slant or whatever to Skoranek. And it was like, I get that Pine is inexperienced, but you're in a playoff game. You have to take a shot. You have to do something. And you clearly dialed up 2 plays because you were scared of turning the ball over. And it's like, you're down 3 touchdowns to Alabama. Do something. Right. And I thought that emphasized that Brian Kelly didn't really think his team had a chance.
I would agree with that to an extent. I think definitely, because before that interception, I think at the time I thought they were deeper than they actually were, like closer into the red zone, but they weren't. But that essentially was a 14-point swing. What could have brought the game within a touchdown, then blew it out to a 3-touchdown deficit. And so I think at the end of the day, the Alabama offense is just too good that I think no matter how close Notre Dame got it, if Alabama had the ball at the end of the game, they were going to find a way to score. But I think you're right that it seemed like we were – and I think a little part of that – I will say a good part of that strategy – was keeping the ball out of the Alabama offense's hands. So they were conservative with the ball. They kept it on the ground. There were stretches of play that it was like 9 minutes with Ian Book out on the field. And so in that regard, I think that was the right decision. You don't want to get into a shooting match with the Alabama offense. You will lose that. But I think you're right. Down the stretch, third, early fourth quarter, you are climbing out of a hole. Like, you're not going to do that. You're not going to get out of that making short yardage gains and not sticking to your game plan.
To Aiden's point, I don't think Brian Kelly ever thought his team could actually win it. I think he was playing for a cosmetic loss like they got because, hey, Notre Dame was one of the winners the night of the national championship because it just everyone was like, you know, every Notre Dame fan on Twitter was like, hey, see what we had to deal with? We held them to fewer points than Ohio State gave up in the first half. So that's just another disappointing playoff loss for Notre Dame still. I hate to end it on that note, but it's the reality. And so now we're moving on, looking ahead to next season, and we're going to talk about new additions and departures for Notre Dame. And I think the best place to start with that would be with Jack Cohn, former Wisconsin quarterback who's now joining Notre Dame, was actually committed to Notre Dame, I believe, in eighth grade to play lacrosse, and then he grew into a pretty good quarterback, and now he'll finally be joining the Fighting Irish for one more year. What? Anybody feel free to just go ahead and you know, shout it out. But, like, what did you think of this when Jack Cohn was announced, when they announced that he would be coming to Notre Dame?
I guess it makes sense from the perspective of Notre Dame likes to keep guys who are older as the starting quarterback. I don't know how much sense it makes in terms of what does this move say to your younger guys that you have waiting at quarterback that think they're going to win the starting job after developing under Ian Book, then to kind of have that taken away as the natural transition seems to appear. But I think it's good that he's only going to be here for 1 year because then that can sort of cushion the transition period. But I do think it's interesting to see. And to me, it doesn't really – I guess I don't know. Maybe I don't know enough to say. But it would seem like there's not going to be a quarterback battle, which is interesting because when Ian Book won the starting job, that was the first time there hadn't really been a quarterback controversy in a long time in Notre Dame football. So it'll be interesting to see whether they kind of stick with that mold of, all right, we're going to pick our guy and we're going to stay with him, or if we're like, all right, we got this fifth year coming in, and then let's give these younger guys a chance and see what they can do.
Before Aiden or Charlotte jumps on, since you mentioned the other quarterbacks, Ellen, here is Notre Dame's quarterback room outside of Cohn. You've got rising junior Brennan Clark, who possibly has a bum knee, and he's only thrown four career passes, completed two of them, one of which was a touchdown to Braden Lindsay against New Mexico in 2019. You've got rising sophomore Drew Pine, who has attempted just three career passes, which is the same number as Clark attempted this past season. You've got Tyler Buckner, who's a borderline five-star freshman, but didn't play his senior year of high school football because California canceled it because of COVID-19. And he missed basically – he only played quarterback for really one season because he tore his ACL 1 year, and he was a wide receiver slash cornerback as a freshman. And then Ron Paulus III, who's a borderline two-star slash three-star recruit and the son of former Notre Dame quarterback Ron Paulus, who is now the, like, associate athletic director or something. So, Charlotte, Aiden, feel free to just go off of that however you want, but, like, that's your reality and why I guess they feel the need to bring Cohn in.
Yeah. My initial thought was like, I don't really get it. Like, we have a lot of quarterbacks, but kind of the more I looked into basically what Hayden just read off, I was like, I don't even know if we have a quarterback. We've got Brennan Clark, who's kind of a liability in terms of health right now. Drew Pine, he doesn't look like a Notre Dame starting quarterback to me.
He's a four-star recruit, but he's just
four-star
not.
Recruit. He's decent. It said something to me that Brian Kelly wasn't willing to trust him to make any kind of throw in that Alabama game. He had two snaps in Alabama, and he gave him two really safe plays, and that showed me something that he did not think he had a backup quarterback in Drew Pine.
And the amount of hype they put into. What Tyler, is it Buchner or Buckner?
I don't even know which one it is. Buckner, yeah. The amount of hype they put into Buckner.
It's not good. It's not looking good for Drew Pine.
I think he's going to be a transfer portal this year or next year. I don't think he's ever going to start a game at Notre Dame. And I would love for that to be a freezing cold take and he leads us to a national championship, but I don't think it's going to happen. As far as it goes, you know, Brendan Clark, you don't know what he's going to be healthy. Paulus, I feel like, was as close to a legacy scholarship as you get. I don't think he's going to be anything in particularly special. And as far as it goes between Buckner and Cone, like you said, Buckner's only played the 1 year. He didn't play this past season. There's questions about what he's ready to do. And the fact remains that Notre Dame has a super winnable schedule next year. They don't have a single Alabama, Ohio State, Clemson type team on their schedule for really the only year and for the next few seasons. So having a really winnable schedule made it really tempting to bring in a quarterback who's had a successful season before. And so I think Jack Cone is a good option. I think he's got a better arm than Ian Book, even if he adds less mobility to the offense. But I think you'll need that quarterback mobility less when you've got a more experienced Tyree and Williams in the backfield, potentially some of those freshman wide receivers making plays. I think Cone's a good fit, honestly, for the offense, and might be a better fit for the offense than Ian Book was. Well, I think they molded the Notre Dame offense into something they shouldn't have been under Ian Book to fit Ian Book's skill set.
Well, because you say they're comparable, here are the two player stats. So Cone did not play last season because of an ankle injury, or this past season because of an ankle injury, started all 14 games for Wisconsin in 2019. Here are his stats from that year compared to Ian Book's stats from this past year. So Cone played in 14 games. He was 200 of 36 for 339 passing. Ian Book in 12 games was 228 of 353. So that's 69.6% versus 64.6%. Cone threw for 2,727 yards. Book threw for 2,830. Cone threw 18 touchdowns. Book threw 15. Cone threw 5 interceptions. Book threw 3. And the one differentiator between the two really is that Cone in 2019 had 56 total carries counting sacks for 22 total yards and 4 touchdowns. And Ian Book had 116 counting sacks for 485 yards and 9 touchdowns.
You forgot another comparable factor. Jack Cone had Jonathan Taylor in his backfield. They didn't need him to do anything. They could have run the ball 70 times a game and won most of their games. But if you watch the film from Jack Cone playing against Ohio State and playing against some of those bigger opponents, he's willing to take shots. He's willing to do things to win games that Ian Book wasn't willing to do.
Yeah, Ian wouldn't. I don't think we've ever seen him make a play like that. So
exactly, you've never seen. Even if Cone hasn't necessarily had all the success, he's had some really good games and some. You know, he almost beat Ohio State in 2019 or whatever it was in that Big Ten championship. He's been good, and he's also willing to say, there's a 50-50 chance that if I make this throw, we win the game, but there's only a 50-50 shot I complete it. But he makes that throw and Ian Book doesn't. Like that, Ian Book doesn't make 50-50 throws. He doesn't trust his receivers to get it done. And he doesn't trust his own throw. I don't know what it is. But Jack Cone's going to be willing to do that. And against a winnable schedule with 5 career completed passes in your quarterback room and a couple of health, like liabilities in terms of health, I think it's a good move, and I think he fits the offense well, and he's going to fit what Reese can do.
My only counter to that is that, and it's what you said about next year's schedule being winnable. Here's Notre Dame's schedule next year: at Florida State, Toledo, Purdue, Wisconsin at Soldier Field, Cincinnati, Virginia Tech, USC, North Carolina, Navy, at Virginia. Oh, wait, did I not? When I said Virginia Tech, it's at Virginia Tech. So Navy at Virginia, Georgia Tech at Stanford. That is a very easy schedule in my mind. And then in 2022 and 2023, Notre Dame has to play both Ohio State and Clemson both years. 2024 and 2025, they play Texas A&M. And then I think in 2028 –
they have a doubleheader against Clemson again down the road.
And then I think it's
that's 22, 23, and 27, 28.
I think they've got two of them.
Yeah, I think they've got one later in the decade. Like, this is the last year for a while that we have, like, a gimme schedule.
And then 2028 and 2029, they play Alabama. That's not really relevant for the current players because none are going to be there for that. it just goes to your point about this being a very easy schedule this upcoming season. And so my point is, I don't want Brendan Clark or Drew Pine or Tyler Buchner or Ron Paulus or whoever making their first career start against Ohio State in Columbus in 2022, because Cohen only has 1 year of eligibility left. Like,
he has two because of COVID year.
But see, that doesn't make any sense, because he played all three of his first 3 years, burned his red shirt. So he sat out last season, but last season was a blanket waiver. It shouldn't matter that, because he's already played 3 years and he gets four max.
I don't know. Maybe Charlotte knows.
No, I don't know, but can I give my two cents on that?
Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So I'm not going to pretend to know much about him, frankly. I'll leave that to you guys. I will say, not surprised by the move. I was fully expecting us to pick up a grad student transfer or some sort of transfer in the quarterback position. Frankly, I kind of thought it would maybe be Dylan McCaffrey from Michigan. That was like the one that sort of made sense. But I was also interested to see like who was entering. There's a few young guys that I think will be interested to see if they enter the transfer portal. But the short of it is, I don't think Brian Kelly, and I don't even mean this is a knock on him, I don't think he's hardwired to do the whole like rebuild. That's not how he's been. I think he actually is accepting of letting a guy who he sees being a part of their future later on sort of get integrated, play a few games, get some snaps in, but he doesn't require them to have that full year under their belt. He's never shown that in the past. So I'm not surprised that the thought of having a brand new quarterback was too scary for him, and that he was happy to accept this. I also think the whole thing about Buchner. I think he will be either I think everyone knows this, he's either going to be a huge bust or a breakout star. He's put up massive numbers in California, but against schools that don't have much of a program. So he either has the talent or he doesn't. He went to that one invitational this past summer, wasn't super impressive, but I think that we'll know pretty early on if he's the future of Notre Dame football. And if not, then they'll go back to the drawing board and figure out either what Cohen's eligibility is, what they have in their recruiting class. Is Drew Pine a viable option? But it might be within the first 2 to 3 games that they're figuring that out.
Here's Jack Cohn's career. In 2017, he played 6 games. In 2018, he played 5. In 2019, he played 14. So he's burned, like, the possibility of a red shirt. He's exhausted 3 years out of 4 possible of eligibility. So the fact that he sat out last season, the blanket waiver thing shouldn't matter at all. It was essentially like he took a red shirt. So
I forgot that his first year was before the new red shirt rule, where it was like the 4 game thing.
Well, it shouldn't even matter though, because he played more than 4 games every year. So
did he play his very first year? He played more than 4 games.
It says 6, 5, 14.
Oh, damn. Never mind. Okay. I think I saw someone that said 2 years of eligibility, but I'm going to stop trusting Twitter.
But my other point about having one of the guys you've actually recruited playing them this season so that they'll have experience for when you play Ohio State and Clemson in 2022 and 2023 is that we've seen in the college football playoff era, you either have to have an absolutely elite quarterback to win there, or you have to be Alabama and pull what they did with Jake Coker, where you're just surrounded by such absurdly talented skill players that you can mask any deficiencies at the quarterback position. Here are the quarterbacks in the college football playoff that have either won a game or have lost by less than 2 touchdowns. Mac Jones, Justin Fields, Joe Burrow, Trevor Lawrence, Tua Tagovailoa, Kyler Murray, Jake Fromm, Jalen Hurts, Baker Mayfield, Deshaun Watson, Jake Coker, Cardale Jones, and Marcus Mariota.
Cardale.
Ian Book does not belong in the same discussion as any of those guys, except for like Jake Coker. And he didn't have the talent that Coker had at Alabama. Obviously no one does. So like, you got to hope that either Buchner is, you know, the next coming of Joe Montana or whatever, or Drew Pine becomes, you know, an elite, you know, reaching his 4-star ceiling.
But I think that Charlotte brought up a very good point in that Brian Kelly doesn't need a quarterback in the system from the beginning of the year on in order to trust him. Like, think about what happened with Ian Book. He went in the Citrus Bowl and won the game for them. And then we come in the next year, expect Wimbush to be the starter. Book gets in, what, like the second or third game of the year and then wins the starting job. And then, like, that's it, after having not been the reliable quarterback that Wimbush was the previous year. So I think if Cone can get in and be steady in the system and not disrupt and kind of, like, let these guys grow up, like, let Buckner and maybe Drew Pine, if he decides to stay at Notre Dame, if he can kind of teach them how to grow up in the Notre Dame offense, then once Cone leaves, then we're back to exactly what Brian Kelly wants, which is a junior or a senior who's going to be ready to lead this Notre Dame offense. So it makes sense from that perspective that he's got 2 years of eligibility left.
I also made I saw a comparison because Notre Dame, I kind of compare their situation a little bit to Clemson at the beginning of the decade, from like that 2010 to 2015 period, where Clemson was kind of trying to break through. They had a couple of New Year's Six losses. One was like a 40-point loss. And they had, I think it was like Taj Boyd or someone at quarterback. He was like a 3-year starter. He went in like the 6th round of the NFL draft, really good college quarterback, didn't win a big game for Clemson. Sounds exceptionally like Ian Book. The year after Boyd left, Clemson brought in, had Cole Stout, who I forget if he was at Clemson or if he was a transfer, but he basically started 1 year. Clemson was okay, and they were fine. And then the year after that, they had Deshaun Watson. And then Clemson's been that good since. And I honestly think Notre Dame's at the point where they're looking for their Deshaun Watson or their Devontae Smith or that player. Clemson is the clearest example of a program that wasn't elite and transition to being elite both on the field and in recruiting via getting a really good quarterback.
Do you think Kyren Williams can be that player, though?
Kyren Williams?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a running back would be that player for any program. I don't think an offense, any recruit nowadays wants to go to see a team on TV run the ball 40 times a game. No recruit's going to look at that offense and be like, that's where I want to go play quarterback. That's where I want to go, whatever it is. You know, unless Notre Dame somehow pulls in Derrick Henry every year on recruiting, that's not sustainable for them. And, you know, you saw that you're going to run into defenses that if Kyren Williams, he ran for 4 yards a carry against an Alabama defense that's really good. That's solid. But you can't ask for him to run for 150 yards in that game. That's ridiculous. You can't ask him to do 140 yards, 3 touchdowns every game like he did against Clemson. So Kyren Williams is an exceptional player. I just don't think he's that kind of like program shifting. You need a quarterback to make that shift. And that's what Clemson didn't have. Notre Dame beat Clemson 4 out of the 5 years before Watson in recruiting. And then Clemson got Watson, and they've destroyed Notre Dame in recruiting since, because they showed an ability to take an elite quarterback and win a national championship with him. They showed an ability to get on the big stage and stay close with Alabama. So that's what it's going to take. And I think Brian Kelly wants to see, is Tyler Buckner that Deshaun Watson type player? But even if so, he's not going to throw him out in the spotlight as a true freshman. That's not going to help his case as a guy that hasn't really played. You know, he's really played 1 year of competitive high school football as a quarterback. And you throw him out as a true freshman at Notre Dame, he might be a disaster just from confidence. I mean, UMich might be an absolute disaster from the start. So bring in a senior who has 2 years of starting experience, 1.5 years of starting experience, whatever it is, who can run an offense, who can make big plays if need be. And then maybe you let Buckner take over as the season goes on. Maybe you're ready for Buckner to take over at the end of the year. Maybe he just wants to give Buckner competition, so Buckner has to earn the starting job from somebody that's not Drew Pine. Like, you know, that's I feel like that's a good move. I just don't have any issue with him bringing someone in, because I just don't think Notre Dame's at that point where they're an X factor, an impact player away from winning that big game. And they need to find who that player is going to be that gets into that stage, that gets into that level that the other programs are at.
This is the last thing I'll say on this before we transition. And I think both what you and Alan just said is completely valid. I'm all for if Cone is the starter at the start of the year, and then eventually the guys beat him out, or even better, if the guys beat him out in spring/fall camp, like they're just that good, like Buckner or Pine is. That would be fantastic. But the problem is, and Ellen, this is to your point about Ian Book taking over for Brandon Wimbush, Brandon Wimbush regressed. Like, they could never develop him as an elite passer like he should have been. He was great running the ball, but that was what kind of allowed Ian Book to take over. And from there, they couldn't develop Phil Dracovic, who had a higher ceiling than Ian Book, to take over from him. My fear is that you bring in Cone, and he's just so steady, and these other guys aren't ready because you haven't given them enough reps before, and Buckner is a freshman, obviously. And so you just ride it out with Cone, and you get 9-10 wins. Maybe you make a New Year's Six game. You get, you know, you keep some pretty good recruiting momentum, but then you're not ready. And I mean, yes, Tyler Buckner could end up becoming Deshaun Watson. It just, this coaching staff has such a bad track record with quarterbacks that if I have to pick what I want to happen, yes, it would be Cone starting and then one of the other guys taking over. I just don't see that scenario happening, because when it was Wimbush and Book, it was like, everyone knew Book beat Wimbush out in fall camp. It was just they wanted Wimbush to start the season against Michigan in 2018 because that dual threat ability gave them the best chance to win. So that's my two cents on that. With that, and since we've been talking about next year, let's talk about the people who have transferred out and NFL decisions. The big NFL ones are Tommy Tremble and Nick McCloud are going to the NFL. And then in terms of transfers, Notre Dame is losing defensive end Oviagufo, safety Houston Griffith, cornerback Isaiah Rutherford, linebacker Jack Lamb, running back Jahmyr Smith, running back slash wide receiver Jafar Armstrong, and backup offensive lineman Colin Grunhard. Also starting left guard Aaron Banks announced he's going to the NFL early. So Charlotte or Ellen, just either one of you, because Aiden just shut off his video for some reason. What do you think of these decisions on the part of the players and what it means for Notre Dame next season? Ellen's just pointing back and forth.
You can take this one.
Yeah. So I am just interested in, okay, to preface this, I was just sitting at the dinner table with my parents, and my dad and I were talking about the James Harden trade, which just happened. And my mom was like, okay, so now how does that work? Is there like a transition period? Is he going to have to sit out for a season, or like what? Cause she didn't really know if the rules were from college. And I was like, no, you can play right away. But I do think it's interesting to me to see this new era in which players no longer have the patience that you have to have in like high school sports. The way, at least where I went to high school, the way that the system worked was that you're a freshman and a sophomore and you're on JV, you're a junior and you might play a little bit, but then towards the back half of the season, you'll start playing, and then your senior year is really like when you have the captains are seniors and you finally get the most of your playing time when you're a senior. And to me, that's just the image of sports that I've always sort of had. I think now in the era that college football has reached, it's not like that anymore. These guys aren't patient enough. They don't want to wait their turn until they're juniors or seniors. They want to either get snaps now as freshmen and sophomores, or they're going to transfer to a program that's either comparable or worse, where they believe that they'll have that immediate gratification. So I understand kind of what all these guys are choosing to do in terms of, all right, they're leaving early because they think they got a shot in the NFL, or they're going to a different program because they think they'll actually get more playing time. But it's just interesting to see how all of that happens at the end of such a successful season. Because in my eyes, when you play team sports, you just have to be a star in your role. And if your role is being on the bench in high school, I guess that's okay. But these guys who are 4- and 5-star recruits don't want that to be their role. So they're going to transfer to a program where they think they can have kind of those first and second string positions. So
I think that's a fair point. And I don't mean to diminish the value of a Notre Dame degree. That said, a lot of these guys have already gotten their Notre Dame degree. And I do think, like, yes, in an altruistic, in its best setting, like, people would stick around for 4 years and be like high school sports. And when you see a college athlete who sticks it out for 4 years and has, like, you kind of get to see them evolve, that's by all means like very inspiring. That said, I understand if you are a player who's maybe was a 4-star, isn't getting playing time, thinks they have the potential to go play in the league, and you have such a small window to make that happen. And that is like Like, that's why I don't blame people who, if they get listed on a draft board high enough, or they, like, they think they kind of max out their potential, it's like, you should take that opportunity, because all it takes is a blown out knee and, like, your career can be derailed. So I don't really, and I'm not sure that that's what's going through all their heads, and I agree, downgrading to, like, a mid-major program isn't necessarily the key to that, but there are very few schools that get players on the sidelines drafted. They do exist, but it's not happening at Notre Dame. It's happening at Alabama. It's maybe happening at Clemson. So if you're a player who's riding the sidelines, you might be thinking, I've already got my Notre Dame degree. I still think I could have a shot. Take Troy Pride. Troy Pride, things worked out for him. He didn't play that much at Notre Dame. He was always, I mean, he did, and he was a starter. That's probably unfair to Troy Pride. But he was always in and out of the lineup. He was always a little bit on the hot seat. So, and things, he's made kind of a spot for himself in the NFL. He's doing fine. So I do think these players, I get there are, I understand the thought process behind taking the opportunity that's given. And if you're not seeing that in that window at Notre Dame, there's only, you only have, I guess now you have 5 or 6 years with eligibility, but there's only a limited window to make your mark and hopefully give yourself a shot at the NFL if that's what you're looking to do. So on that same note, I would just like to take this as an opportunity to advocate for the expansion of the college football playoff for this reason.
Yes, yes. Wait,
here we honestly, I'm coming around.
Argument every single week.
I'm coming around on it. I see Aiden's point about, like, yes, Notre Dame and Texas A&M playing in that 4-5 seed game would be more entertaining than Notre Dame Alabama right away. Alabama would crush anyone anyway, so why not give us more playoff games, I guess, is the argument. And
also,
like,
also, you, it seemed like every week leading up to the, every day leading up to the bowl games, there was a new, you know, one or two players who was a senior who decided to sit the game out because they were preparing for the draft. And it was like, I get it. What really do you have to gain? This isn't March Madness where you have all this hype and, you know, there's a game after that. If you're playing in a New Year's Six Bowl, that's what?
The Music City Bowl.
Yeah. Like, what do you have to gain from, but you have everything to lose if you're a draft prospect. But if you're playing for the shot at getting the national title and you're, you know, the sixth team going up against a three, you're going to show up. It is worth it. You do have something to gain from that. So I just think the level of competition, and if players still make the decision to sit out, then so be it. But I think right now you're not giving seniors or draft eligible players any incentive.
Imagine like UNC, Texas A&M in like a first round game, and UNC actually has Javonte Williams and Michael Carter and Daz Newsome, I think, that also opted out.
De'Ami Brown.
De'Ami Brown, the other receiver. Like, they had three of their top five offensive players, and they stayed, and it was 41-27. Can you imagine, like, a first-round playoff game that's, like, 45-41 in, like, a 4v13 game? Like, that's possible in college football. We don't have to see a 16-over-1 upset for us to want to expand the college football playoff. That doesn't – you know, it's just not going to happen. Like, we can't say, oh, because Alabama's good, we shouldn't have an extra playoff games. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
I mean, it just makes the non-playoff New Year's Six games irrelevant, essentially. Ellen, I'm sorry I interrupted you. What were you going to say?
Well, here's my problem with the whole thing. We can't even get two competitive games. Okay. Neither semifinal this year was competitive.
Let's see.
How are you going to get four or six or eight competitive games?
I'm not asking for 4 to 6 to 8 competitive games. But for one thing, we've given the committee an impossible job. We've told them pick the four best teams, but also pick the four best resumes. Like, that makes no sense in the context of a college football season. Winning the Big 12 over the past couple of seasons was not good enough to be in the top four. Like, by like the skill level it took to win the Big 12, not one of the top four teams in the country. Resume, you have to put the Big 12, an undefeated Big 12 champion or a one-loss Big 12 champion in the playoff. Right. You don't have to do that if you have Oklahoma go up and play Alabama in the first round of the playoff and get smacked because they would have last year. Like, you don't, you can have better games and get better teams in the semifinals.
The thing is, you are only delaying the inevitable. There weren't even two teams that could beat Alabama this year. You're not going to get seven teams that have a shot at beating Alabama.
Okay.
If you play off eight teams, there's going to be one, maybe two, maybe three teams that have a shot at actually feasibly winning the title. So if you put if you throw however many more teams in the playoff with them, you're just delaying the inevitable of them getting
a I disagree with that.
I just can't.
That, okay.
The problem is, if you're just going to lose to Alabama anyway, then why am I going to play? If I'm going to
that, because you're not going to increase the parity in college football. It's going to be horrible. You're just going to have Bama, Clemson, Ohio State forever. Nobody's going to want to, like, there's going to be no parity ever. And now think about last year. LSU's number one, right? Bama's number 12. You put Bama in the playoff, you don't think they're hunting for a rematch with LSU in the national
championship? But they don't have Tua. It's Mac Jones.
It's Mac Jones, who's been better than Tua.
But he wasn't.
Mac Jones is better than Tua.
Mac Jones wasn't as good in 2019 as he was in 2020. Look,
Mac Jones was better than Burrow after he took over as starter, statistically. He was better than Joe Burrow. From that point in the season on, he was better than Joe Burrow. You can't tell me that Alabama LSU in the semifinal would have been less entertaining than LSU Oklahoma.
Not three teams, not seven teams. No one's going to beat him, so why are we going to put seven more teams in the playoffs?
Because does Loyola Chicago have a chance to go to the Final Four? No, they didn't. But
you play 50 basketball games a year. You only play 12 football games, and that's for a reason, because you can't let these guys get hurt right before they go on and they want to have a career in the NFL.
Okay, but that's an easy enough solution. If the question's too many games, take out the FCS games that you play every year, or the crap game Notre Dame plays against Bowling Green. Take an 11-game schedule, have a 3- or 4-round playoff. It's the same length season.
All right, this debate devolved very quickly. We've had this debate before. This is not what we intended to do on this podcast, Charlotte. Thank you for hijacking this. We're gonna move on now. We've said enough on the took enough time with that. We're gonna talk about Marcus Freeman, Cincinnati's defensive coordinator, now Notre Dame's defensive coordinator. Just want to know what you guys think of that hire. Replacing Clark Lee, who's going to Vanderbilt. Is this an upgrade in your mind, a lateral move in terms of like a Notre Dame perspective, a downgrade, an uptick in recruiting? Like, just how do you guys see this? Anyone just jump right in.
I think personally it's an upgrade for a few reasons. One, I think you've got to acknowledge the LSU a bit. Granted, that doesn't mean anything once he's there. We don't get points for beating out a team for a hire the same way you don't get points for beating out a team for a recruit. But I'm just impressed that Notre Dame managed to pull it off. But from what little I've watched of Cincinnati this season, Marcus Freeman seems like he has a very good game management style. He's known to be a very good recruiter, which I think I'll get to that later in my fact or fiction. But I think this is a good hire. Clark Lee will be tough to replace, but I think we got about as good as we could. While I'm talking about it, I do have to share his son's names because I just think they're amazing. They're so Italian. He has Vinny, Gino, Nico, and Rocco. So I'm really excited to see them hopefully on the sidelines or something. But yeah, short of it is, he was in the talk for potentially inheriting a mid-major head coaching job. So I think that this is as good as it could get to replace Clark Lee, which will be a tall task to do.
I'll kind of echo that. I think he was the best option available. There's a lot of teams that wanted him, LSU obviously being prominent in that search for a defensive coordinator. So it's hard to say whether it's going to be an upgrade until we've seen him with Notre Dame. But I think it sends a signal to where Notre Dame is as far as being a program that they can go out and get the top guy, like clearly the top guy that's available for a new defensive coordinator position. So I think that sends a definite message to recruits being like, you know, this is where we're at. The best guys want to come and coach for us. I think the biggest thing he's an upgrade in is, and this might sound weird, I don't think Clark Lee was fantastic at prepping for offenses. I think he was really good at adjustments. But how often did Notre Dame get torched under Clark Lee in the first quarter or in the second quarter or get scored on like 2 or 3 straight drives?
Yeah, that was a problem against Clemson in the AC Championship and the Cotton Bowl and Alabama in the Rose Bowl.
And
that,
UNC, yeah. To an extent, we got, yeah, murdered in 2 drives straight before he figured it out. Like, Marcus Freeman has been an all-around solid defensive coordinator with less talent. So I think, and maybe the, you know, kind of the hype of having his real first, like, blue blood program type of role. I think, I don't know. I feel like Clark Lee, it felt complacent that he trusted his ability too much he didn't look like he was ready at all for big games. And then he kind of figured it out as he went, which showed how good he was, but his inability to be ready for that moment in the first quarter, definitely, I felt like it showed through in big games. So I'm excited for that aspect of Marcus Freeman.
Ellen, what's your take on it?
I agree with Aiden. I think you made exactly the right point, which was that the in-game adjustments were great. The preparation, Notre Dame, it seemed like, especially in the ACC Championship and the Rose Bowl, they just looked like they had never watched a single minute of film in preparation for the offenses they were going to see, which was disappointing because you would think, especially with those games when they had weeks to prepare, that that would happen. So hopefully Marcus Freeman will offer that. I do think that one other thing he's going to offer is that he has real in-game experience in a competitive program. He was a linebacker at Ohio State. He bounced around the NFL for a couple years. He knows exactly what he's asking of these guys because he's been in that position himself. Clark Lee, I think, maybe played for a year or two after playing college baseball. So he didn't really understand the game the way that I think Freeman will, especially since Freeman is young. And this does sort of seem to be the approach that Notre Dame is taking, especially with the Tommy Rees hire, is let's bring in these young guys who know the system of modern football as it's being played and can really connect with and relate to our players in a unique way that maybe Brian Kelly's not able to. So from that perspective, I think it's a really smart move. I agree with Charlotte in that it was encouraging to see him choose the Notre Dame job over other good opportunities. But I think he has a good future, and Clark Lee will be hard to replace, but I think that Freeman is as up for the task as anyone could be.
All right, we are going to move on now to fact or fiction. I do want to say I think Freeman's a great hire, obviously the best one you can get, and I agree with Aiden. We'll have to wait and see what he does, but I do think he'll be an upgrade in recruiting. Probably like a 1 to 2 year rental for Notre Dame, but you can look at that in a positive light, as in, like, he'll probably do so well as a defensive coordinator that he'll get a head coaching job after 1 or 2 years. So now moving on to fact or fiction, and since Aiden has to take off in just a little bit, we're going to let him do his first. So Aiden,
yeah, take it away. I'll start with one that's a little out there, but kind of relevant to what we were discussing earlier. Fact or fiction, Notre Dame has 3 different quarterbacks see meaningful playing time next year, whether it's starting a game, getting into the game in whatever weird format, you know, just kind of 3 different quarterbacks at one point receive non-garbage time playing time for Notre Dame.
Well, Cone will, that's almost a given. I think the streak of needing 2 different starters in a season, like Ian Book was an anomaly in the Brian Kelly Notre Dame era in that he, in the last 2 seasons, did not need someone to start in his place during a game. That was almost a every year sort of thing for Brian Kelly. I think with a rebuilding offensive line, someone's probably going to take a hit and you're probably going to need another starter. So I think at least 2 will. I have a hard time seeing 3, but I think that there's so many question marks. Yeah, I'm going to go with 3. I think that, yeah, it's just too much uncertainty at the position. You're going to have to do some trial and error to figure out what works. What do you guys think?
I agree. I also think, as we've talked about a little bit, the opportunities that the schedule presents itself. I think that this is Brian Kelly might feel a little bit more comfortable getting some maybe Brendan Clark, Drew Pine, kind of getting them in the mix. I also think in his heart of hearts, Brian Kelly loves a good quarterback controversy. We haven't been reminded of it in a while, but I think that's sort of his brand. So who knows, maybe we'll see the old purple faced BK make an appearance. Hopefully we can leave that in the past, but.
Yeah, my initial instinct was fact, like these guys. But the more I think about it, the more I actually want to say fiction. I think without the Cone transfer, that's fact for sure. I think with the transfer, it's fiction, because I think we're going to see exactly the same thing that we saw this year a little bit with Ian Book, and even kind of last year with Ian Book. I don't think Ian Book was that good last year, but Kelly trusted him and left him in the system and developed him. So that way this year, I thought he really looked a lot better than he had. But I think that Brian Kelly is just going to get too nervous. Like Aiden, you talked about those snaps that Pine played in the Rose Bowl were not meaningful. It was just kind of like, let's waste time until we can get Book out of the injury tent. So I think that Cone will win the starting job. I think the second guy, unless there is a legitimate battle in practice, I don't like, and one guy is able to kind of leapfrog another for the second string job. That's the only way we would see three guys. But I kind of think that whoever is going to be that second guy is going to solidify himself in spring ball, and Brian Kelly's going to want to trust in that guy enough to set him up as kind of the heir to the system once Cone leaves.
Aiden, what's your take on your own fact or fiction?
Oh, I've changed my mind about seven times since listening to all of you guys talk about it. My initial thought was fact. I'll stick with that just kind of for the sake of talking about it. But my initial thought is that Brendan Clark might start a game next year. I think Brian Kelly loves Brendan Clark, and he let Brendan Clark play at back in like 2019 against like New Mexico, taking him out early and letting Brendan Clark get a touchdown pass. He showed me a little bit that he kind of liked Brendan Clark and saw him as a guy that might make plays in the future. I think his health was a huge question mark this year, which resulted in Clark not really getting any meaningful throws in. But I think he's going to be a serious competitor for Cone if he's healthy. And I think that could be a situation where you might start a guy and then be like, wait a second, we've made the wrong decision, or we need a spark off the bench. We're in trouble against Florida State in the first game of the season. Get somebody in there. You know, maybe you start Clark and then you realize you need the experience that Cone brings. And I think ultimately later in the year, Buckner becomes the guy that starts down the stretch. So I think, and like Charlotte said, I think Brian Kelly likes a little quarterback controversy. I think he's not going to really name a starter until late in the summer. So I think there's a lot of opportunity. And then there's obviously Drew Pine. Like, I think he's good-ish. He's okay at football, but I don't think he's that good. So I think he has an opportunity to get playing time. I really think Brendan Clark's going to get an opportunity to start. I think he's going to get that chance based on how Notre Dame has treated him within the program. So between four plausible guys that could get playing time, I think the possibility of three of them having meaningful snaps is pretty high.
All right. Before we move on in fact or fiction, and Aiden is going to take off, I ask, you covered Notre Dame football for the first time this year and in a pandemic, no less. Just what was your favorite moment from this season, and what do you take away from this year?
So what I took away, favorite socially distant press boxes are amazing. That was so much better than the first time I covered a game. No offense. I was sitting next to Hayden. It was awesome. We had a great time, but having nobody within 12 feet of me was so nice. I could spread out. I had my lunch on one side, it was so nice. So that was one takeaway. I'm also going to tie that in, 'cause I covered the Florida State game this year, and that was, besides Clemson, which I know we're not allowed to talk about, is our favorite year, favorite moment. Florida State was my favorite moment, not necessarily because of the performance on the field, but like Notre Dame football coming back. I honestly, there was a 2-week period there where I didn't think college football season was going to continue. Teams just seemed to be dropping left and right, games getting canceled, Big Ten hadn't started. Things just looked really questionable, and I didn't think they were going to play. So football coming back in the form of night football against Florida State in South Bend, winning 42-20, whatever, 26, I think. It was a really fun night. Even if I wasn't in the stands for that one, that was my favorite moment of the year.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Aiden. It has been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast, trashing Kentucky basketball and football for me.
Always.
All right.
I'll continue doing it next year, even when you're not here, Hayden. Don't worry.
I'll be glad to listen to that as an alumni. Thanks, Aiden. Have a good night, man.
Peace out, guys.
All right. We will now continue fact or fiction. Do either of you want to go, or I can take it from here? I'll take that as me taking it from here. All right. Fact or fiction? The fact that Tommy Trimble left early for the NFL will be a net positive for Notre Dame down the road.
I'll say fiction because I think that Tommy Trimble, I expected him to have a much better or much bigger role this year than he did. And so I don't think his presence really like added much. It kind of seemed like the Michael Mayer show a little bit. And it kind of seemed like what Charlotte was saying earlier, Trimble saw an opportunity with his name on a draft board somewhere and was like, I got to get out of here before I lose every single snap to Mayer. So I think from my perspective, it kind of made sense. It was sort of like, gosh, maybe he should have left even earlier than he did, because I thought his preceding season was even better than this one he just had.
Well, this is the first year he's eligible for the draft. So
yeah, yeah. But it's still just like on paper, like statistically speaking, like theoretically, if he had been eligible. I would say fiction, and then it's a net positive because I think it's kind of like a net neutral. Like it doesn't, I don't think it really changes much for our offense.
So are you saying that it, what was your line, Hayden?
It, fact or fiction, it will be a net positive for Notre Dame.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with fact. Frankly, and this is probably not a fair analysis, hearing the reports that despite however many like coaches and players reached out to him and kind of encouraged him to stick around next season, apparently his mind was made up. I think that in and of itself, if there's anything I've seen in the NFL or in the NBA, is if a player doesn't want to be there, you don't want to keep them around. It could turn. Now, I don't think in college that's really not nearly the same. It's not going to turn toxic because there's not trades and stuff, but it sounds like he was ready to get out. And so I do agree. I think Michael Mayer is going to be better than Cole Kmet. I think he's already given him runs for his money. He's really, really good. And I think Tommy Trimble had a lot of potential. I think he could have a good NFL career. He's certainly plenty athletic. He's good size and he has good hands, but I think that this will open up more opportunities. Both, I think primarily we'll see like George Takacs emerge. There was another tight end that I'm spacing
Kevin on. Kevin Bauman.
Okay. Yes. I think that those guys will step it up, and I think Mayer will kind of evolve as a player and mature. So I'll, no disrespect to Tommy Trimble, but I think this will be a net positive in terms of the team's cohesion.
My perspective, what I was going for was that he was used so much as a blocker this past season. And if he came back for another year, they would probably get him more involved in the pass game, which I think would actually be better for his draft stock because he showed he's a great blocker, but like he kind of double clutched a few balls, you know, didn't have the steadiest of hands, even though he was a fine pass catcher. But my mindset is like, they will now focus more on the wide receivers instead of taking like another Northwestern-ish transfer, you know, like Ben Skowronek. They'll actually develop a guy like Jordan Johnson or Xavier Watts or Lorenzo Styles and in work, you know, these wide receivers, you know, just to get them better. So you don't have to rely on two tight end sets as much. You can actually get a little more exotic with maybe two running back sets or, you know, go, you know, a trips offense or whatever and just run a bunch more wide receivers out there. So that's why I think it's a fact, but I could easily see it being a negative if the staff doesn't end up, you know, utilizing the wide receivers to their full potential. Ellen, you're unmuted currently, so do you have a fact or fiction to go off of that?
Yes, I do. But just tacking on to what you just said, the only problem with running the trips is that you have to have three good receivers, and that might be a little bit of a struggle for us.
Yeah.
Okay, so fact or fiction, Notre Dame's place in the 2021 AP poll at 15 is appropriate.
In their way too early prediction?
Yes. Like, that's a suitable, reasonable, fair ranking. Fact or fiction?
I'm going to say fact. Me and my dad were actually debating this tonight a little bit. I think The Athletic, Stuart Mandel, had Notre Dame at, like, number 10. I kind of like that because, like, they finished number 4 this season. They were in the college football playoff, and I feel like you should reward teams somewhat for their performance in a previous year. But if we're being objective about it, like, Notre Dame loses so much, 15 just seems far more realistic to me than number 10. Then again, the 10 to 15 to 25 range, it's really not a lot of difference between a lot of those teams. So I'll say fact just to, you know, get my homer out of me a little bit and be fair about it. But I could really see it going like from anywhere from, you know, 10 to 15 or 10 to honestly, even 20 would be all right by me, I think.
I'll agree with that, in part just because I think sports at every level and across every sport, they overvalue blue-collar programs. You know, think about it. OU and Oklahoma and Notre Dame are two programs that benefit so much from just being Oklahoma and Notre Dame. And the fact is we're losing a lot of pieces. Now, in 2012, we were maybe ranked 25th. We may have been out of the top 25 and we ended the season second. So I'm not saying that because I think that they're, given their schedule and given some of the pieces that they had coming on in that freshman and sophomore class, that there's no reason to think they couldn't be top 10, but they certainly have done nothing at this point to prove it. So I think that's a fair analysis.
I'll agree in that that's true, but I think they could have gone a little bit higher. So I don't really have an opinion beyond the fact that, to me, the rankings don't matter before, let's say, like week 10. I think it's so arbitrary. I just pulled up the 2020 season, like way too early preview, and the top 5 teams are Clemson, Ohio State, Alabama. So sure, that all worked out for this season. And granted, this is all with COVID not clearly interfering. But then the next teams are Georgia at 4, Penn State at 5, Oregon at 6, Florida 7, LSU 8, Oklahoma 9, and Notre Dame 10.
Yeah. I mean, it really just shows LSU that, like.
What did you say, Shark?
You put LSU in there?
No. This is the rankings.
Yeah, with LSU on there.
LSU was 8th.
In the
early 2020 preview.
It really just goes to show that Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State are on a whole nother level. Where in their, like, that 1-3 range, you really can't go wrong. But then, like, the 4-10 is its own thing, and then 11 through, you know, everyone else is its whole other thing. So, yeah. All right, Charlotte. Wrap up fact or fiction.
Seems fitting that on what could be one of my last podcasts, I actually have a fact or fiction for like the first time. My fact or fiction is that Notre Dame will get their highest rated recruiting class next year, class of 2022, since Brian Kelly's been there. The last time this incoming class is ranked 9th, class of 2021, and the last time that they were within, the only other time they were within the top 10 was in 2013. They had number 5 ranked class, but with Marcus Freeman's addition, they've got 4 commits so far, but I'm gonna say that they're gonna get that best. That's my take. You guys can take it away.
All right, let me see who they got in 2022. I know they have Joey Tenona, is that right? He's a the 4-star offensive lineman from Indiana, I think. I see what you mean with Freeman contributing to the recruiting rankings, but I just, Notre Dame is not as hamstrung by the you know, the rules about, you know, like the academic standards in recruiting as a lot of people make it out to be. They are, for sure, but like I think it's just, Ellen, do you want to go? I've got to kind of sort my thoughts out on this a little bit.
Yeah, I think I'll disagree with that a little bit, because I was talking to one of my friends about this, and since COVID, as we know, all a bunch of classes online, what are the odds that Alabama football players ever go back to class in person? Like, if I'm Najee Harris, if I'm Devontae Smith, if I'm whoever, like, I'm not there to play school, to quote Cardale Jones.
To be fair, a lot of the Notre Dame players were online, so I don't think
Ian Book was online all his classes, so yeah.
Right, but how much of that has to do with being online for preventative reasons and being online for, I don't really know how well I can keep up. So, well, I mean, yeah, and maybe that's being a little bit too generous, for a little bit too optimistic about what the Notre Dame guys are there for. But in my eyes, if you're going to like Alabama or Clemson or Ohio State, you know that you're not going to have to do anything in the classroom. In Notre Dame, there's at least some basic baseline expectation of, all right, you have to be able to hold a pencil and sit in a classroom for 50 minutes at a time. Like, all that is not even answering your question, Charlotte, but I think that, I guess this is just a long, very long way of saying, I think that it's possible that they could have their best recruiting class, but I don't see Notre Dame ever breaking the top five recruiting classes just based upon the expectations that come with playing for a team like Notre Dame.
They currently have 2 4-star offensive tackles committed, a 3-star safety, and a 3-star tight end. I don't see Notre Dame cracking the top five, if that's like what we're, you know, if you say it's the best of his Notre Dame tenure of Brian Kelly's, and five was what it was in 2013. I don't see them hitting that, just because, I mean, they're taking so many commits in this cycle that I think it limits how many they take in the next one. And it is a numbers game. That's a big part of it too. Notre Dame gets players, they go after guys that they think will fit the program really well. They don't like to take risks with guys that are like really high upper echelon recruits who may, you know, just decide to transfer either because they're not getting as much playing time as they would want to right away, because we've seen the staff put 5 stars on the bench, Jordan Johnson. I just don't see it happening. What do you think, Charlotte?
I think it's fiction. The more I think about it, I think that 2013 year was kind of a fluke deal. You got Jalen Smith from Indiana. You had Max. I took a picture of it.
Max Renningfield.
Yeah. Unfortunately, things didn't really pan out for him, but he was an early commit.
I think was in that class.
Isaac Rochelle was in that class. The big one, obviously, was Jalen Smith and getting him from Fort Wayne. So I don't think that we have those pieces. Now, I do think recruiting will, depending on how long we have Marcus Freeman, you know, say what you want about Tommy Reese, but I think he's probably a pretty good recruiter. At least there seems to be a public, like, publicly, there seems to be a good relationship between him and his players, which is half the battle, just getting players to want to come play for you. So I think that the longer he sticks around, things will continue to kind of consistently, Notre Dame might move into that 5 to 10 range, because right now they've always been just outside that under the Kelly era, but I don't see them making that big of a jump in 1 year.
All right. Well, with that, final fact or fiction, possibly, of the year done, we're going to do another podcast around National Signing Day to break down the commitments and stuff a little bit more, and maybe we'll do a fact or fiction then. We're going to do a fact or fiction then. It's what everyone listens to this podcast for anyway. But like I did with Aiden before we go, I do want to ask you guys to share your favorite moments from this season and what it's meant covering Notre Dame football for the final time as students, since we're all seniors. Either of you want to go first? If not, I have Jimmy texted me his, since he couldn't join us, and I can read his first. All right, your silence means I'm reading Jimmy's first. So Jimmy said his favorite moment this season, like Aiden covering the Florida State game, was getting to cover Clemson. Said the game was covering the game truly felt like a once in a lifetime experience, and is definitely something I will never forget about. Just being able to cover the team all this year was a blessing, and the unprecedented nature of the year made for quite a roller coaster of a season. I was really grateful for a season even being made possible with all that's going on in the world, and I was truly grateful and blessed to be able to cover it. Aren't we all? So very, very sweet, heartfelt message from Jimmy there. Do either one of you want to follow that one up?
Just a note on what Jimmy just said. That's so cute that he said that, because my computer background is actually one of the photos he took from the press box at the Clemson game. Because he took a series of four really great photos from that. So I'm glad that he enjoyed his time up there.
Well, Ellen, what would you say was your favorite moment from this season? And just what did it mean to you to cover it in – to cover college football, Notre Dame football in 2020?
Well, kind of like Aiden alluded to but didn't really say, I mean, the favorite moment has to be the Clemson game.
I know, and that's why I said if – because that would be all of our favorite moments. But, like, if we're going to put that to the side, what do you think would be your favorite?
I think my favorite moment – let me think about this.
If you want to take a sec, I can go while you're thinking.
All you.
Or if that one, go for it.
Yeah, Clemson game aside, Charlotte, you go first. I'll think about this for a minute.
I was in, because, yeah, obviously the Clemson game's a given. I do remember the first game against, gosh, who did we play? Duke.
Yep, Duke.
And granted, that was so early on. We were all in, like, our assigned seats. All the RAs were, like, off in a corner, and we kept, like, waiting. It was truly such an experience. But I remember when they played The Boys Are Back, and it was, like, electric in the stadium despite being, like, 90% empty. And it sort of –
Dropkick Murphys.
Yeah, and, like, after – not the High School Musical version, although also a classic.
There's a High School Musical version? Oh, wait, that's – I know what you're talking about. Was that a Dropkick Murphys cover they were doing?
No, it's a total –
okay, okay, okay. You need to watch
High School Musical. Also watch High School Musical, the musical series. There's so much drama. I'll fill you all in on that later. I could start a whole other podcast about that if anyone wanted to know my thoughts. But anywho, I do remember like being in the stadium, and I think at that point I'd been at school for like a month and a half because the season started late and got there early. And it had, needless to say, but I think that first month and a half was brutal. Morale was low, and it was like an instant serotonin boost, and to sense that like, okay, some things are normal, like some things are going to work out, and like, this isn't the same, this isn't how we imagined our senior year, but like, we're lucky to be here. So yeah, that was that. I will, unless Ellen, if you have, otherwise I have one other thing to add. Okay. I was just going to say, allow me to get like emo and emotional here for a moment, but I was thinking the other day about like one of my very first memories was when I was 5 at the Notre Dame UCLA game. Jeff Samardzija scored a game-winning touchdown with 20 seconds left. Actually, when I was on that podcast with Ryan Harris, I was like fangirling because that was like truly, I thought that was like the peak of existence. And that's that was like, I grew up a Notre Dame fan. And I think at some point during my time covering Notre Dame sports, I grew a little bit, I don't know if complacent's the word, but I just started to take it for granted. Like I didn't understand how special it was. One, that we got to go there as students, and two, that as students, we got to cover Notre Dame sports. We got to like really see it on the ground, be a part of things. I definitely took for granted the last time we got to go out on the field our junior year. I did not nearly soak that in enough. Who knew that that would be essentially the last time we get to do that. So all things considered, it has been a great experience, and I realize how lucky I am to have gotten this for the past 4 years. And we got, what, 20, I'm trying to think of the record. We lost one home game throughout our 4 years.
Georgia in 2017.
Yeah, it doesn't get much better than that, so.
Ellen, do you think of your moment?
Yeah, it's a tough act to follow. I think my favorite moment would have to be the Florida State game, sort of like Aiden said, but it was just, it was the beginning of October, but it was just such a beautiful day. Like, I think I was wearing shorts and a t-shirt that day. And it was sort of just kind of like what Charlotte was saying. It was just like, all right, here's something that we thought really wasn't going to happen. We didn't think we were going to have football. And it's October in South Bend. It's probably going to be miserably cold. And it was just like a great day. And the game was at night. And so we just kind of got to spend the whole day just like tailgating, if you want to say tailgating, but just kind of like doing what we could. And just to like have such a big win. Like watching Notre Dame put up 42 points is just like an absolute blast. So I think that was probably my favorite moment from the season. But I guess, well, I mean, that aside from the Rose Bowl, because like that was the coolest thing ever. Who gets to cover a football game in an NFL stadium? But yeah, sort of just like what Charlotte said, I don't think people really realize what an opportunity it is to get to like be a part of the Observer. Like, I don't think people understand what kind of doors it opens for you in terms of like just getting to cover Notre Dame football, being in the press box. Like, I sat next to Pete Sampson at the Rose Bowl, who I'm, for all of our qualms with him sometimes, like, he's a very well-known sports reporter for Notre Dame. So just kind of like being in that setting, getting that respect, just like all the opportunities I got to cover the women's basketball championship in Tampa my sophomore year. Like, I got to see Holly Rowe and Maria Taylor walk by. Like, how cool is that? So just like all the wonderful things and having such great teams to cover. Like, this isn't Bowling Green or even like Cincinnati. Like, this is Notre Dame football, and the respect that people put on it and like the tradition that comes with all of it is just certainly something that is very cool to be a part of.
Fantastic recruiting pitch for any prospective Observer writers listening to this. Yeah, I mean, obviously I would say my favorite moment was Clemson running around on the field shirtless, seeing Ellen slowly recognizing it was me with my shirt off and shoving me.
I did not know you were shirtless. That is new information.
I was wearing like a green Notre Dame hockey jersey. I had tied it around my neck like a cape. So I was.
Just, had no shirt. I was wearing an electric blue tracksuit, and I was just like sobbing. And we were just like, "Oh, this is the best day of our lives."
Socially distanced, of course, of course.
Socially distant on the field. I wasn't on the field. I would never do that.
Yeah. I saw someone throw marshmallows because it was our technically senior night, but they didn't throw, they just threw a bag of, like, a closed bag of marshmallows on the field. It was hilarious. So, yeah, obviously that was my favorite moment. I could pick so many. Chris Tyree's 94-yard touchdown run against Syracuse because, like, oh my gosh, I love seeing Chris Tyree run. Ian Book flipping the ball like nothing against North Carolina was ridiculous. If we're going to do like our journalism moments and covering Notre Dame, it would probably be me covering the season opener against Duke. I had checked out a camera from DeBartolo for one of my journalism classes, and they didn't let photographers on the field. So I took it upon myself to take that up into the press box, and I took photos from the balcony of the game, and my parents, God bless them, went and they took the Observer copy of the Observer that had my photos published on it and got it framed for me. My lone photo credits of my.
I can remember looking at that and being like, Hayden's getting a photo credit tonight.
I know, it was incredible to see not just my name all over for the insider stories, but also for all the photos. Although I should say it wasn't my parents that got it framed. It was Santa Claus that got this framed for me. Don't ever stop believing, kids. So yes, it's been an incredible ride, and I want to thank you guys. I want to thank Aiden and Jimmy. Obviously this has been the craziest freaking year imaginable, in sports and just in regular life. You guys made my life a lot easier. The entire sports department made my life so much easier when we did our senior edition and just covering every sport, not just football. So I want to thank you guys a lot from the bottom of my heart for that. This really is our so depressing. Why am I crying in the club? Ellen, yes, this really is emo hour out here, Charlotte. Yeah, thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone who listened to this all season. It's been a blast covering Notre Dame football for the second year for me. It's been a hell of a ride. And we're coming back. Like I said, we're gonna do National Signing Day, and I'll probably be back on with Aiden and maybe Nate, Greg, Liam to lament Notre Dame basketball and how it rips my soul apart watching them not even try to play defense. But Brian Kelly, Ian Book, for all the things that infuriated me, thank you for giving me 4 years of fantastic football. So yes, I'm gonna get off now before I start making more people cry and before I start crying myself. On behalf of Ellen, Charlotte, Aiden, and Jimmy, who couldn't join us tonight, thank you to everyone who was listening. We will be back later, as I said, for National Signing Day. Thank you again so much for listening, everyone. Just stay safe out there, and thanks again.